This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
All right. Hey. Welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. It's February 1st, 2022, and we're talking about the Craft Malt Conference, which is coming up virtually in a couple weeks in February. Thanks so much for joining us and support heritageradionetwork.org. Become a member. Well, let's go around the room and introduce the guests. These are two of the keynote speakers of the Craft Malt Conference. Let's start with June.
Hi, Jimmy. Good to hear your voice. This is June Russell. I am Director of Regional Food Programs with the Glenwood Center for Regional Food and Farming. Previous to that, I spent 17 years with GrowNYC working for Green Market, which is a market operator here in New York City. And while I was there, I spearheaded what became the GrowNYC Grains Project. And that was about 14 years of working on some initial policy and development there, and a lot of value chain work. And then we ran a pilot program at the markets that lasted for about 6 years, where we were aggregating various grain products from producers across the Northeast and getting them out to markets in New York City. And it was a great project.
And you're also the keynote speaker for the Craft Malt Conference. So we're going to now just introduce Joel.
Hey, everyone. How's it going? My name is Joel Alex. I founded started my craft malt journey back in 2012, 13, when I conceived sort of this idea to try to get some of the grain grown in Maine into Maine brewed beers. Found out that wasn't a wholly unique idea, and there were a couple other people at that time doing it, including Valley Malt and a few other people in the region. Got really inspired, and basically spring of 2013 worked to try to get that processing here in Maine. And oh geez, was it 8 years later? No, yeah, 8-9 years later. Here we are. We kind of commercially scaled in 2015. At the time, we were the largest traditional floor malting operation in North America. I think, you know, Admiral Malting, Gray Malt out in California has like maybe a little bit larger than us now. But we're still doing floor malting. We've, you know, I think at last count, we've moved just around 5 million pounds of Maine grown grains cumulatively into the regional markets. And we're really, you know, our purpose is to try to grow markets for our regional agricultural products. And I know we're going to probably talk about this soon, but, you know, the Northeast Grain Shed Alliance, I know June's involved with that. Like, we've got some grain connections through them. So, you know, that will all come up, I'm sure. And yeah, we're just excited to be doing this and to be supporting the amazing craft beer industry, you know, here in our community.
Wow. Thanks, Joel. And then I just want to give a shout out to Jesse Bussard, who's the director of the Craft Maltsters Guild, which is also running the Craft Malt Conference. Unfortunately, there's some kind of weather issue. She's not able to get internet, but I want to give her a big shout out, because the last year she has coordinated quite a few Craft Malt themed episodes with us. And we will be back with her around the Craft Malt Conference, which is again, like, starting February 18th, it's online, but you got to check it out. Joel, what's the website for the Craft Malt Conference.
Craftmalting.com is the guild's website. So you can definitely go there. And then within that, is there a, I can Czech thing, but I think if you go to craftmalting.com, you'll be at the guild. The guild is who puts on the craft malt conference, and you can get all the information there. So, yeah.
All right, so let's get into the show. So start with June, because June, I want to know how you, as an inspector for the green markets, ended up becoming this wizard of grains in the Northeast. Because tell us how it got started. So there were bakers, I know this, there were bakers in the green markets in New York City. Some were from farms, some weren't. And then they didn't get any flour, right, from farms or anything then.
Yeah. Yeah. So there were conversations that predated me. I moved into that position in 2007, and it was kind of a simmering issue. And, you know, Michael Horowitz was like, take this, do something about bakers. And, you know, discovered that there was some initial groundwork there where, you know, Don Lewis had been working with grain from Alton Ehrenhart and incorporating fresh flour into his baked goods. And so we had, you know, I started with those two. Alton was an organic grower, so he really saw the value of having small grains in rotation. And he was also a little contrarian of, you know, pushing back on this notion that you couldn't grow wheat in New York. And he was just, you know, doing a small amount for his family, and then teamed up with Don, and Don started using that in his baked goods. And so, you know, we knew, like, okay, it's not impossible. Somebody's doing this here. But they had this initial policy that required bakers to source all of their flour locally. And this was 2004. So I come from the food business background, Jimmy. That's how you and I met there on First Street. And, you know, I had spent 15 years in production and all kinds of roles. I spent time at Zingerman's Bakehouse when they opened up, and that was like a second wave of artisan bread happening in the United States. So I had enough basic knowledge about baking and what bakers would need. You know, was not an expert by any means, more of a jack of all trades, master of none, but that, you know, the ability to communicate is where I came in as a facilitator. I understood gluten and structure and things like that. So, you know, could a person who was a predecessor in my position did a survey. It was, you know, the one document that I had to start with. And she had surveyed the green market bakers around what they were using. And so that was kind of a first look at, like, okay, well, this is what people are using. What's out there? And it kind of lined up with my position because as I was doing inspections, I was out in the whole region, the Northeast region. The green market has a defined region for eligibility that covers most of the Northeast, stems from midway through Pennsylvania, New Jersey, New York, up to the Finger Lakes, parts of Vermont, Massachusetts. And when I started, you know, looking to find out, like, okay, is there anybody doing this anywhere? One thing I knew for sure, that 100% was not feasible. That was not going to happen. So it was a well-intentioned policy, but it was not an achievable policy. So that was, I started with that question of, like, okay, if we reset this, what should we reset it to?
So June, so back then, even the farmers, they were making baked goods, but they were just buying like wholesale or supermarket flour.
Oh yeah. I mean, the exception, funny story with Sharon Burns, leader of Bread Alone, you know, they were always dedicated to organic flour. And so some of the pushback I got from them was like, we're already organic. Like, you expect, we want us to go local. What? So, you know, you could sort of see that as like, that's was its own standard. And there were a few folks that were dedicated to organic. But other than that, you know, big range of commodity, you know, just a couple of artisan bakers at that time. You know, Milanaise was used and recognized as a good quality flour. And he was definitely, he meaning Robert Beauchemin, who was the miller at Milanaise, had, he was one of those guys who was a back to the lander from the 1970s, who started up a milling operation. And so, you know, 30, 40 years later, he's got a mature business, and we learned a lot from him. We learned a lot because he's an organic grower who really adapted his supply in that part. If you look at like the Northeast, like that part of Quebec is still part of our bioregion, even though obviously it's not part of our national region. But yeah.
So June, so just to help us, so even 15 years ago, 20 years ago, other than a cute little mill in Rhode Island that's making white cornmeal, there wasn't, what was the connection? So you're saying there's farms, there's mills, there's malt. I mean, I still can't believe it even happened.
Yeah. I mean, it's all been, this has all been grassroots, organizing, convening, building momentum and movement, and really relational power of community, for sure. You know, I've went to field days sometimes where there's only 10 people there, but those 10 people were really passionate, and they come back 3 years later and had launched a business. You know, NOFA New York was an important ally, you know, in doing those field days and the conference being a real point where folks could come together and meet in the winter. And we did a lot of workshops, June, there.
I just like want to interrupt here because I actually, long time ago, we actually met there. One of my first forays into malting was, I think, the NOFA conference in March of 2013. Came out there, listened to Valley, Andrea speak about Valley Mark, and I'm sure I heard you speak too, and I'm making spider bread. And you're right, there's not a lot of people, but the passion, you mentioned it a couple of times. And it's a passionate group of people early on. It's inspiring.
Joel, why don't you, let's get to there and how you got started, because it was like whatever June was doing was a wizard's role, you know, resurrecting something that used to be so commonplace. But how did you get started in craft malt, man?
I mean, I think like passion, I was an educator and a like community organizer prior to Blue Ox Malt House. And I was actually thinking of going back to grad school to do some kind of like social entrepreneurship, specifically around food system. My kind of academic background was sustainable development, but I was kind of like ireless, drifting around in terms of trying to figure out what I wanted to do. But then I got really connected with food systems and food and where our food comes from. And the idea of just like food being such a great entry point for thinking about sustainability, because we all consume it. We all have a relationship to food, and maybe it's a healthy relationship, maybe it's not. But if we like knew more about it, I think we would also naturally start to think about other systems. It's just such a great entry point. So anyway, I kind of got excited, and then I was talking to a craft brewer at a potluck on a farm in Cornville, Maine, and we're just like, you know, he was lamenting he couldn't use local ingredients, and we were talking about it. I had done some home brewing, but I had never really connected the dots. And then it was like, yeah, well, we just can't actually get malts. And people are doing some hops, but nobody can do the malting process. And I was like, well, that's like silly. And I had friends who were growing grain. I was like, we gotta solve that. And then I just started doing the research and finding else who was doing it. And like I said, Valley Mall was doing it. There's Riverbend down in North Carolina. There's a couple other small places that were at most 2 to 3 years old. And I just got really excited about it, started seeking out opportunities like the NOFA conference in 2013, where, you know, at least crossed paths with June, and met Tor Orschner and some other people that maintain relationships with and have since been able to buy grain from. And yeah, just like became so impassioned by this that it quickly became what I wanted to do. And I kind of quit my job. when I started, I had been an AmeriCorps member, and I had only like $2,500 in my bank account because AmeriCorps members are paid a stipend of nothing. And I say I live based out of my car because I certainly had friends and family around the region that I was couch surfing on. But for the next 18 months, I moved all over the state of Maine and really tried to like get the momentum and the chops, both in malting, technical expertise, and business planning, and grain growing, and really just try to like put the vision together. So, fast forward and here we are. it's every year we work with well over 100, and increasingly we're working with more and more regularly. I would say, probably at least three dozen really regular customers, who are ordering monthly. And if you extend to like people that we work with specific brands on, I mean, we work with an enormous amount of the breweries, both in Maine, but in New Hampshire and Massachusetts and around the Northeast. And it's just really exciting. It's been a really...
Joel, can you mention a couple of the breweries that you're working with now? Because yeah. One thing about craft malt is a little confusing, because I know that, like, the Brewers Association has an independent craft beer seal. But how do I know if someone's making... Like, I know some breweries make batches with craft malt, but not the other batches. And I really like the flavor of craft malt.
Yeah, it's, I'll answer that. You know, it's like sort of funny because when I started, there were, I think, 33 operating brewing licenses in the state of Maine. And I was like, oh, there's so many. By the end of the first year, so going to 2014, there were 42, I think. And I kept track of all of the breweries in Maine and that we had worked with, up to 84, and then I lost track. I can certainly like highlight some different breweries that we work with, but I won't be able to highlight all of them, which is a shame. Someone that your listeners are probably familiar with, Allagash. They've definitely been a leader in working with small grains and craft malt in the region. I think this past year they reached a goal they set for themselves. I think 3 years ago, to use over 1 million pounds of Maine grown and processed grain. They're continuing that commitment. And, we've been a part of that, which has been awesome. But we're also seeing, we've been working with newer breweries. We'll get there. But, there's some small breweries like Bellflower in Portland, Maine, that we've been working with. We'll come back to them later. And then there's just a lot of small tasting room focused breweries like Brunswick, Maine. There's Moderation. We've been working increasingly outside of the state, connecting with breweries like Lamplighter in Cambridge, Craft Roots, which has always had a really strong commitment from day one. And they're in Milford, Mass. I hope I'm getting the names right.
No, that's a good start.
Good. It's like I could just keep going. I mean, the whole hour everyone that we work with. So
we're coming back, and you're doing your job. Now let's go back to June. So June, I cut you off, but let's keep rolling with you because you're the timeline that made all this possible, I think.
Well, it's been a lot of people. A lot of work across, the country at this point, for sure. And Joel, I do remember you. I remember crossing paths with you, and maybe even had an email or two.
Yeah.
I think that it's been a fascinating journey, I'll tell you that, because when I first was kind of given this assignment, I'm going to just tell the story, because I actually felt kind of disappointed. I was like, what are you talking, like baked goods at the farmer's market? We're talking about cider donuts and muffins and who cares, whatever. So many interesting like varieties, vegetable varieties coming along. But, a few years into it and connecting with the researchers, and this is largely the organic community who's really like making clear like the case about the soil and crop rotation and small grains having their place. And really the assignment was to add value to those grains, right? And so, we can do that through, in the food world, like through niche markets and really emphasizing those unique attributes. A lot of that flavor, it took a while for people to recognize flavor. There's a lot of skepticism that could really exist in something like wheat or barley, as you guys are experiencing. So many things, and it's really been operating in this non-commodity market that's been so fascinating. And a big, big, big piece of it is people who are values-based. We see that at the market constantly where, that's where people who prioritize their food for whatever reason it is. It's like their food is important to them, how it's sourced, where it's come from, how it's treated, is a really big driver. And that's been, I think one of the key relational pieces that this, community building work has been about. And then of course you combine like food and beverages, and then all of a sudden everybody's having a great time. Like it's been, really connecting the agricultural world and the food world. It's been super, super satisfying.
What were the big hurdles? I mean, you had to get people to plant, but what's the whole chain, the grains chain? I mean,
it really does start with research. And so, one quick story there was that, Mark Sorrells, who's the head of the breeding and genetics department at Cornell, has spent his entire career there. And it was only a few years ago at one of our events that he had something with his own wheat in it. He'd spent his entire career disconnected from what he was actually producing. And I've always been really blown away by that. It's how can you spend your entire career disconnected? Like you've been cultivating different wheats and looking at different characteristics, and you've never tasted a cookie, with your or a beer, and to see it's been so animating for him to have that experience. So I think part of it is that, how we've been so siloed by the larger food system, how, in this one in particular, when you get to grains, we're talking commodity. It's an entirely different universe than what we've been operating in. The Northeast has a lot of small farms. We didn't have any of the background. We lost generations of knowledge and experience that did not get handed down. You guys in Maine maybe had more than most because your potato growers had been growing oats. And maybe, Maine was a little quicker to be able to pivot into production and sort of.
In some ways, I mean, there's definitely challenges though. Where like it's a potato culture, and it's certainly there are, this is not a blanket statement at all, but if I think about like the general attitude, and there are definitely some people we worked with who had this attitude, which was like, I just try not to lose money. I just put the grain in and I let it grow, and I try not to lose too much money on it so I can get back to potatoes the next year. And June, and Jimmy, you know, at this point, you have to manage your grains, and there's a high to be able to source this market. And every year there, the farmers do a lot of work, to get quality, you know, that we as maltsters need, or that bakers need, or and that people ultimately consume. So, you know, there's definitely like a lot of management and effort that goes, that farmers who really are making commitment to this work are doing, and you have to change a culture, and that can be a really hard thing to do, especially with farmers who, you know, when you first start talking to them, you're both like, you know, facing the same direction, and slowly as your relationship builds over time, you start actually looking at each other and facing each other, and you're talking. I mean, it just takes time to develop those relationships, but that's really any relationship. So it's not, I shouldn't say that, but also Junior, you're absolutely right about the researchers. That was my experience as well. It just really invigorated all these people in the malting industry who were just like crunching numbers before or doing barley breeding. And they were just so excited to have people care and interested about what they're doing. And that it gets back to that passion piece, which you already mentioned. But yeah, just to be part of a passionate community is really invigorating, especially for some of these researchers who have made it their life and no one's ever really cared about what they do.
So Joel, you guys at Blue Ox Malt House in Portland, Maine, I got to know you a little bit because originally the conference was going to be in person in Portland. And I was really looking forward to going up, but because of Omicron and all that, it's back to virtual. And one thing that was great about the virtual conference last year is that I got to participate because it was based out of Montana, but I was in so many great breakout sessions. I talked to Aaron McLeod, who I know June knows well, and some other friends from all over the country. And as a result of sitting in on the Craft Malt Conference, thanks to Jesse Broussard, I got to talk to maltsters and brewers and distillers from around the country this year. So how did your specialty is what? Floor malting? Tell us about that and what it is and how that's different. I remember years ago, Aaron McLeod said, who was at Hartwick, he had learned the industry in like Western Canada. And he said, basically what I learned was that there's not just a truck full or you know, a container vessel or whatever of malts coming out of Canada. He said it was like entire trains were loaded with malt and or the grains for the malt. So what is floor malting and how does that define what you're doing? Because sometimes I want to know what is craft malting. Does every craft maltster have to floor malt?
No, definitely not. You know, I think we're all small businesses and, you know, each of us have a unique business model and choose, you know, the methods of that we malt with kind of based off of where we are at. The specific thing about floor malting, and just like if you humor me for a second, probably a lot of your listeners already know this, but I mean, the malting process is really simple. It's in theory, it's just soaking grain in water, letting it germinate, and then basically baking it or kilning it down to a dry product. Then there's some like cleanup afterwards to get it all bagged up and ready for brewers. But those steeping, germination, and kilning processes can use all sorts of different equipment and methods, just like there's a lot of different types of brew systems out there. And so, you know, a lot of what you see in the industrial malting operations and even some craft maltsters for different reasons, you utilize this, is you'll see these pneumatic systems where you might do the steeping in one vessel and then the germination and kilning in another, and maybe it's a drum or maybe it's a flat bottom vessel that looks like a mash tun. For people kind of trying to visualize this, or you do it where you steep and germinate in one vessel and you dry and kiln in another vessel. or you do it in three different vessels. And with floor malting, what makes it different is like we do the steeping and steep tank, then do the germination on a malting floor, which is the method used in a lot of traditional European malthouses, and really notably, and a lot of people, you know, connect it with distilleries in Britain and Scotland. So we're doing that germination piece where we're taking the grain that's been soaked in water, we're putting it out, we're couching it, as it's called, on a floor. So building a mound of it, spreading it out, and then over the course of many days, 4 to 5 days, we are gently raking and interacting with that malt to turn it over, to help it release heat that it's generating during the germination process. And before we then load it up into our kiln, and at our malt house, we have a single deck kiln, really great to produce a variety of base malts, from like Pilsners to Munichs. It's just really gentle. It's really hands-on. It's very physical. We have a team of about five, six. It feels like it's constantly moving. I just hired someone else who come in and help with the physical nature of that. But that's definitely part of our mission too, is to provide good jobs for our community. So even though it involves a lot of manual labor, which is, you know, something not everyone has, or, you know, is able to do, you know, we have the space, we have the ability to do it, and we're able to like kind of work with a staff of about five people. Overall, we've now got about nine people in the malt house, so we're slowly growing. It's a fun team to be a part of. But anyway, I'm starting to go down all these different holes. But the floor malting, the floor malting is just that germination out on the floors, and. You know, I like to say that we're a mixture of like traditional techniques with like modern technology, because in the old floor maltings, they would open windows to kind of control temperature, and it would be too cold in the winter and too hot in the summer. So you can only have like a period in the fall and the spring where you could actually do the malting. You know, we've mechanized that. So we have a cooler room. We keep it at a nice even temperature, so that like helps us get the consistency and help us control and tweak for the quality that the brewers want and their performance of their products, and it helps us, you know, develop unique flavors. I mean, just like you can take a beer, you know, of the same recipe and brew it on a lot of different beer systems, and it will always taste different brewer to brewer. The same things for malt. I mean, us craft maltsters, we're all sourcing, you know, regionally and locally. So you already have that layer of uniqueness. Then you look at, you know, the variety of methods we all employ. Even if we were to use the same grain, just because our methods are slightly different, you would get different results from every craft maltster.
When you guys are floor malting, do you actually use your nose? I mean, do you smell when it's done?
Oh, absolutely. Like you can smell it. I mean, you walk into that room, and if you're not, you know, it's a quality control piece. I mean, there's a whole range of smells that happen. So you get the kind of like dry hay, just like the raw grain just has this, like the raw barley. We mostly work with barley. We do work with wheat and triticale and oats and rye. But we're mostly doing barley, and you get this like nice, like hay, summer field kind of smell. And then you soak it in water, and then it actually almost smells like cucumbery and like sweet, like cucumber, right when it's coming out of the steep tanks, and then the initial kind of day or two of it being on the floor. And then over time, it kind of develops like a bread doughy kind of smell. If I could like say that, as it gets ready to go into the kiln. And of course, then you go in the kiln, you dry it down, and then you get those like traditional quote unquote malty, you know, dry malt sweetness and crackers and graham crackers, or depends on the type of malt. And it's just, it's delicious. If you are smelling something, there are lots of different smells in the malt house, and they all should be good smells. If you're smelling anything that's like sour or unpleasant, you know there's an issue, and you go and you find out what it is, and you do what you can to either remove it or correct it.
Oh, that's great. Hold on. So back to June. So June, in your long career, what's like one moment that really stands out? Like you're trying to get farmers to grow small grains. You know, was there a moment when people had mills or malts, or was there some other moment? Was there one person that really took the lead that you said, wow, this is really happening? Did you ever realize it was happening while it was happening?
I mean, every year there are milestones, right? Like there were, so it always seemed like there was, you know, there's been steady growth for sure, right? And, you know, I think a milestone of, you know, having She-Wolf come to market was a real milestone where, you know, they proved that you could make really good quality bread. And, you know, you look now, like you call it the modern bread line, but it's like people just at market, there's long lines here for Green Market for their bread. You know, so I think now it's just like there every year there's a little more. There's a little more. And, you know, I think we're hitting this tipping point. You know, I think one really motivating thing was early on when we had, you know, I think our first convening and gathered folks. And, you know, they always say, you know, that farmers are so conservative. And it's like, well, sometimes they really jump in, you know, they just jump all in. And there was a grower who did that. And he called me up at the end of that year and literally chewed me out. He's like, you're misleading the farmers. I grew wheat and I couldn't sell it to the mill. And they said, well, how long have you been growing? And of course, they didn't want to talk to me after that. So, you know, he didn't know the specifications. He didn't understand. Learned over time. It generally takes a grower 5 years to really become good. And which makes sense. Like they say in the food world, takes 10 years to become a chef. That kind of understanding with the crop that you're working with. But, you know, that was a really big motivator. Like it definitely stung to get chewed out by a farmer. And very, made me very motivated to try to make this work. You know, that we do create markets. But there's been just, you know, it's been, so the complexity has been unreal, like particularly with wheat, but you know, it's only marginally less complex with barley too. Just, you know, what it really takes.
June, I think we each think the thing we work in is most complex or probably equally complex. It's just a matter of what you're paying the most attention to.
Hey, hold on. We're gonna take a short break in a minute, but let me give a shout out to a beer I'm drinking. I'm drinking Exhibit A Brewing out of Framingham, Mass, the Briefcase Porter. They have a long relationship with Valley Malt in Central Mass. And it says, we worked closely with our friends at Valley Malt to develop the custom roasted malts in this beer, brown malt, chocolate wheat, and chocolate malt. And I will say that I love a malt, craft malt type beer like that. So we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. And of course, there's the 2-Michelin-starred Blanca tucked away in the garden for truly daring diners. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
So hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. Become a member and support us at heritageradionetwork.org/donate. Hey, the Craft Malt Conference is coming up in February, and we're doing a pre-show with two of the speakers, June Russell and Joel from Blue Ox Malt House. Joel, just tell us a little bit about what you'll be talking about at the Craft Malt Conference, because both you and June are key speakers.
Yeah, thanks. So I'll be talking in the second weekend, and I mentioned Abermalt earlier in the show, and I'll be talking with Curtis Davenport over there. We actually went to malt school together in 2013. We'll be talking about floor malting with Gabe Troth moderating, and just doing presentation to like tell people about why they might want to floor malt or why they might not want to floor malt. So it's kind of the ins and outs. I mean, floor malting, it's got a lot of great benefits. It produces a really well-developed malt that performs really well for breweries, is really flavorful. But, it also involves a lot of floor space, a lot more manual labor. So, we'll be going to the ins and outs of floor malting and hopefully getting a couple converts and helping people understand whether it's a good choice for them.
All right. And June, you're the keynote speaker. I believe, are you talking about this theme, it takes a village to raise a glass?
I had not planned on that, but maybe I'll work that in somehow for sure. For sure. I think when Jesse contacted me and I was like, are you sure this is like malting and beer world, but she said, they really were looking for somebody who had some background and I guess the kind of work that I've done, like background about the Northeast and the evolution of our, this sector of our local agriculture. So yeah, definitely, talk about some of that journey. I think one thing I've been thinking about is, what's unique about the Northeast and how small grains fit into our farming systems here. So different. I've spent a few years out at the Cascadia Grains Conference in Washington State and working with some partners out there, and just really different, landscapes and assets there. So we each have our challenges to what building these networks look like. But I think when I go back to this origin of the work for myself and what has made me so committed to it, really comes back to the health of the farming system and the healthy soils. But it really extends so far beyond that. It really extends then to health of rural communities and health of our farmers market communities and how those things kind of, are, we all depend on each other, that kind of reciprocity that happens.
Absolutely.
Well, listen, we're going to talk to both of you again, because you guys are so awesome. And I love this. It takes me back to Pete Brown, who's one of my favorite English beer writers. A couple of years ago, his book was called Miracle Brew. And he actually talked about the key ingredients of beer. And he said that the average person, and in his case in England, thought that beer was made from chemicals or was just made in a factory. And just talking to you guys, it's really true. It does take a village to raise a glass, because that whole farm to glass thing, you don't just clap your hands and it happens. And thanks for that little insight into the work that went into this. And we're really looking forward to following what you guys are going to say and the whole Craft Malt Conference. And thanks again, Jesse Broussard, for helping coordinate this show and all the support you've given us. And we've learned a lot about craft malt this year and so much more to learn. So thanks again, guys. Thanks to Armin, our engineer, who's going to clean this up. And a big shout out. Thanks to June and Joel. I'm Jimmy Carboni. I'm the host here on Beer Sessions Radio. We'll catch you next time. All right. Woo. Okay.
Thanks, Jimmy.
Beer Sessions Radio is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.